Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'm reading are from the December 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, A Grand New Design. After a 1902 train wreck in the heart of Manhattan, one self-taught engineer proposed an improbable urban transformation. His vision reshaped the face of American cities. By Michelle Stacy. Early on the morning of January 8, 1902, two young women, Sadie Scott and Minnie Rice, stood on a snow-covered train platform in New Rochelle, New York, waiting for the 7:48 a.m. express that would take them to their jobs as stenographers in New York City. Nearby stood F.S. Cowdery, a banker on Wall Street, and 21-year-old H. Frank Crosby, who worked at the American Locomotive Company on Broad Street. It was the dawn of the commuter age, and the passengers were pioneers of the suburbs, traveling daily to the rising skyline some 20 miles to the south. Not long before, their hamlet of New Rochelle had been a tiny resort destination for wealthy city dwellers. By 1890, though, it had been transformed into what the New York Times called a perfect nest of metropolitan commuters, thanks to the railroads that served it. Even the subsequent commuter had been supplied by the train system. A railroad engineer on the New York Central Line, remembered only as M. Sloat, noticed the number of repeat customers and proposed giving riders discounts for monthly and yearly tickets. The full fare was commuted, and with one bold entrepreneurial stroke, the railroad commuter, in name at the very least, was officially born, writes Sam Roberts in Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America. When the train from Danbury, Connecticut, arrived at 7:48, the crowd flooded into the two rear cars, which were reserved for New Rochelle passengers, who were among the last to board before New York. Several would-be travelers who missed their usual train would later wonder at their good luck. The train pulled away and began its rush toward the city and the final leg of the run, the Park Avenue Tunnel, notorious for its heat, soot, and fumes. Park Avenue was not yet the elegant boulevard of today. Coal-powered locomotives ran down the street's center day and night, belching steam and smoke. In the face of public complaints, a half-hearted effort had been made to improve the situation in the 1870s. The powerful and wealthy Vanderbilt family, which owned the New York Central Line and the railroad right-of-way on Park Avenue, agreed to lower a portion of the tracks to just below street level and cover part of the route south of the 92nd Street down to the train depot on 42nd. That created a shallow tunnel of sorts, in effect a roof over the tracks, with occasional vents for the smoke and steam to escape. But the salutary effects on Park Avenue were negligible, and the, quote, improvement created a new hazard, the dark, smoky tunnel itself. At 8:20 a.m. that January morning, the train from Danbury was stopped in the tunnel under 56th Street, waiting for a go-ahead signal, when another train, an express, from suburban White Plains, smashed into it from behind. The passenger cars of the Danbury train took the full brunt of the collision, while the heavy White Plains locomotive was relatively unscathed. The engineer later said he had been blinded by smoke and steam, which caused him to miss the red lights, signaling him to stop. The result was horrific. The engine of the White Plains Express plowed halfway into the last car of the train traveling through New Rochelle, its boiler landing amid passengers, spewing steam and coals. Windows shattered, wood splintered, seats and the people in them were crushed. An account in the Boston Daily Globe noted that, according to survivors, the two ends of the car moved together, like the ends of an accordion, until, of the long car, all there was left was a space 9 feet long, in which was jammed passengers and seats in a hideous tangle of mangled misery. On the street above, bystanders heard the collision and the screams for help, and some joined policemen and firemen in clambering down ladders into the wreck. Firefighters used axes to chop their way into the ruined car, driven by the moans and cries of passengers. Acting Fire Chief Thomas Friel told the Globe, "Women and men, dead and injured, lay on top of each other in all positions." Clergymen and doctors from nearby churches and hospitals climbed down into the inferno to comfort the injured, give last rites to the dying, and try to save those they could. Many volunteers were working like surgeons on a battlefield, the Globe reported, describing one doctor's white hospital gown as red from blood from his collar to the hem on his trousers. Sadie Scott and Minnie Rice had been sitting together, and the force of the collision threw Rice part way out a window. Both were trapped by the wreckage. They stayed calm as rescuers worked to free them. "Don't tell our folks we are much hurt," one said, as they were finally extracted, before they were taken to the hospital with wounds to their heads and legs. F.S. Cowdray, sitting in the second-to-last car, was reading the paper when he heard a tremendous crash and found himself pinned between two shattered seats. He groped his way through a cloud of steam and climbed through a window, then helped two women escape. Young Frank Crosby was not as lucky. He was counted as one of the 15 killed that day. Two died later of their injuries. When Crosby's father, mother, and three sisters learned the news at the New Rochelle train station, both parents fainted from the shock. Around 40 others were injured, some gravely. A recently married couple, William and Amanda Howard, perished in the wreck. Their funeral was held in their home, with the caskets placed side by side where the two had stood when they were wed 6 months before. Amanda's death had been particularly heartbreaking, as she was alive and being tended to by firefighters when the steam pipe that was trapping her burst and killed her. All of this was a tragedy foretold, says Kurt C. Schlichting, author of Grand Central Terminal, Railroads, Engineering, and Architecture in New York City. People had been warning for years there's going to be an accident, and when it happened, all hell broke loose. People wanted to indict the Vanderbilt family, and they demanded that steam engines in the city be eliminated. The tunnel disaster would become a turning point for the nation's largest city, altering its very geography. Out of the wreckage would emerge, seemingly out of thin air, acres of new buildable land in the heart of the metropolis, which in turn enabled the creation of the storied Park Avenue of today, with the glorious new Grand Central Terminal at its head. And beneath the new land and the terminal, engineers installed a revolutionary train track system that, in time, as it was copied across the country, helped drive the explosive growth of the suburbs, transforming American life for decades. The ripple of lasting change extended far beyond New York in other ways, supercharging the growing popular backlash against the so-called robber barons, such as Cornelius Vanderbilt, who engaged in questionable business practices and amassed huge fortunes while putting profits above their workers and customers' health and safety. The day after the accident, the tunnel crash was already a force for change. New Rochelle, now a mourning city, headlined the New York Times. The town's citizens were planning a meeting with their mayor to insist on better railroad safety. The indignation had a clear target, the Vanderbilt family, who owned the New York Central, Harlem, and Hudson Railroads, as well as the deadly Park Avenue Tunnel, through which every line north of the city passed. The Times editorial page on January 9th decried the slaughter in the tunnel and called out the railroad for its negligence. The people will no longer expose themselves to the appalling perils of the conditions under which the slothful and incompetent New York Central managers exercise the privileges of their franchise. New Jersey's Evening Record addressed the family directly. "Don't you think you have killed enough people in your economy tunnel?" it asks. "The people will eventually decide to try some of you Vanderbilts for plain murder." Several newspapers noted that two great-grandsons of Cornelius Vanderbilt, Cornelius III and Alfred Gwynne Vanderbilt, ran over from their nearby mansions after the crash to peer down into the tunnel. The Vanderbilts had for decades been emblematic of 19th-century tooth and claw capitalism. The Commodore, as Cornelius was known, had risen to extreme wealth from humble roots on Staten Island, starting his own ferry service between the island and Manhattan in 1810 at the age of 16. He made his first fortune in shipping and steamboat travel, and his practices were so cutthroat and monopolistic that in 1859, an editorial in the Times called out his predatory methods and compared him to those old German barons who, from their eyries along the Rhine, swooped down upon the commerce of the noble river and wrung tribute from every passenger that floated by. A decade later, in 1869, still long before the family faced an outcry over the crash, Mark Twain published an open letter to Commodore Vanderbilt in Packard's Monthly, in which Twain accused him of breaking the laws of your country and jeopardizing the lives of your passengers during his steamship days. "You observe that I don't say anything about your soul, Vanderbilt," Twain wrote. "It is because I have evidence that you haven't any." By that time, the Commodore had seen the future in railroads and begun snapping them up. When he combined the Harlem, Hudson, and New York Central lines in 1870, it created one of the largest corporations in American history. The Commodore's son and heir, William H. Vanderbilt, further tarnished the family's reputation in 1882, when he was quoted in the New York Times. In response to a question about whether his train lines should keep the public's interests in mind, William said, "The public be damned. I don't take any stock in this silly nonsense about working for anybody's good but our own. Railroads are not run on sentiment, but on business principles and to pay." The "public be damned" statement was widely publicized, stoking outrage and becoming a rallying cry for social critics and the burgeoning populist movement, which went so far as to call for government ownership of the railroads. By the time of the Park Avenue Tunnel accident, those progressive sentiments had a ready ear in the White House. Theodore Roosevelt was keenly sensitive to the public demand for restraints on corporations and to the need to contain their power, says T.J. Stiles, author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. The 1902 disaster highlighted a particular aspect of the effort to make corporations more accountable. The fact that they constructed what were essentially public works and provided an essential public service as common carriers. Schlichting, the author of Grand Central Terminal and a historian of New York, says the accident was also a wake-up call for the city's growing middle and upper classes, many of whom were rail commuters. They felt the shock of "that could happen to me," he says. The idea grew out, "We're going to regulate the way industry provides goods and services so they don't wreck people's lives." The clear way out of the tunnel dilemma was to replace the steam engines whose smoke had contributed to the crash with non-polluting trains run on electricity. Electric power was still in its early days, first used in New York around 1880 for large-scale arc lights in public spaces like hotels, theaters, and streets. By 1888, the first streetcar line was converted from steam to electric power in Manhattan, followed by a similar system in Brooklyn in 1892. But heavy-duty railroading needed more voltage than relatively lightweight streetcars, which required only about 15 horsepower, Schlichting says. That's equivalent to a modern-day lawnmower. By contrast, loaded railroad cars and heavy engines would need to be amped up to 2,500 horsepower. In 1902, this had only been accomplished once, when 7 years earlier the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad opened the first electrified mainline railroad, covering a small stretch in the Howard Street Tunnel. The cost of redesigning and installing an electrified track system throughout New York City and the northern suburban area would be enormous, requiring extensive new infrastructure. The directors of the New York Central, which controlled all rail access from the north and down to Grand Central at 42nd, realized they had no choice. 8 days after the accident, they announced a $10 million electrification plan. They acted ahead of the inevitable. In 1903, both the city and state of New York outlawed steam locomotives in Manhattan, effective July 1st, 1908. But that daunting project was only the beginning of New York Central's problems. The existing Grand Central Station, originally called a depot, had opened in Midtown Manhattan in 1871 to great fanfare. It featured towering mansard roofs and a soaring train shed topped with an enormous glass and iron dome. At the time, the largest interior space in North America. But though it was built to last a century, by 1902 it was already hopelessly outdated, disorganized and overwhelmed by surging numbers of passengers. Meanwhile, north of Grand Central was a vast open train yard, a mass of tracks spanning about 23 acres, occupying blocks and blocks in the center of a bustling metropolis. The train yard was not only an eyesore, it also created an impenetrable barrier between the east and west sides of an increasingly busy area that was rapidly filling with new homes and businesses. These related challenges presented an opportunity for a visionary, and New York Central had one in its midst. The railroad's largely self-taught chief engineer, William J. Wilgus. The son of a freight agent at New York Central's Buffalo Station, Wilgus had from a young age been fascinated with engineering and what he later called its mathematical exactitude and aesthetic charm. Those qualities found expression in the Grand Central project and many other Wilgus ventures that followed, including the Holland Tunnel, as Schlichting relates in his 2012 biography, Grand Central's Engineer. With no family money to fund a college education, Wilgus apprenticed with a civil engineer for 2 years, learning engineering, mathematics, and mechanical drafting. By age 34, he had worked his way up to the top engineering spot at New York Central, despite an outspokenness that often put him at odds with those in power. In 1902, Wilgus immediately set his mind to solving the unprecedented problems facing New York Central. Suddenly, there came a flash of light, he wrote years later. It was the most daring idea that ever occurred to me. Wilgus laid out his ambitious scheme in a 3-page memo to the Central's president. First, sink all the tracks coming into Manhattan deep below ground, only possible once they were running on non-polluting electricity. In addition, stack them on top of each other to create 2 levels, one for commuter trains and one for long distance, allowing the 4 tracks that enter Manhattan in Harlem to expand to more than 40 as they approach Grand Central. And finally, to service the new underground infrastructure, build a new, larger, even grander terminal designed to handle an ever-increasing ridership, which had risen 300% in the previous 3 decades alone. The whole thing was a technological leap, an unbelievably complicated feat of engineering, Schlichting says, and it was going to cost a fortune. 3 million cubic yards of earth and rock would need to be dug out and carted out of midtown Manhattan, and an electrical power system created to accommodate new locomotives. Wilgus estimated a total outlay of $35 million, nearly half the Central's annual revenue of $82 million, an estimate that rose in the following years to upwards of $71 million. The price tag initially staggered his bosses, but Wilgus followed up with an ingenious way to pay for it, a concept he called taking wealth from the air, literally. Wilgus proposed using the ancient but rarely implemented concept of air rights, which dated to early English common law, based on a Latin maximum that said, to whomever the soil belongs, he also owns to the sky and to the depths. Once the much maligned train yards were buried in the ground and covered with heavily reinforced girders and pavement, Wilgus argued the resulting real estate, already owned and being used profitably by New York Central, could be leased to developers, thus reaping additional millions in perpetuity. Unlike simply owning or buying land and leasing it out, air rights provided a legal way to double dip, run a profitable train business underground, and also profit from what was formerly unbuildable acres overhead. And that is exactly what happened. The skyscrapers on Park Avenue today don't sit directly on land, Schlichting says. They're perched above the 2 massive cement terminals that Wilgus built. They have no basements. Wilgus had outlined an entire city within a city, built on the reclaimed land, and it arose within 2 decades after the opening of the new Grand Central Terminal in 1913. Eventually, the neighborhood included hotels like the Biltmore, Commodore, Ritz-Carlton, Waldorf Astoria, Roosevelt, and Park Lane, some long gone, and iconic office buildings like the Helmsley, originally the New York Central headquarters, and the Chrysler Building. Park Avenue was reborn, destined to become a grand dame of American boulevards, a street lined with luxury apartment buildings and sky-high corporate towers, with flower beds running up its center median for miles. In 1935, newspaper editor and writer Arthur Bartlett Maurice wrote, "The story of Park Avenue is the old story of Cinderella. Yesterday a kitchen dredge of a street, today a resplendent princess. And the fairy godmother who waved the wand and wrought the change was electrification." If Park Avenue is Cinderella in that metaphor, the magnificent Grand Central emerges as the castle. Before it could be constructed, though, 8 years of backbreaking work were required. In the spring of 1903, the directors of New York Central faced, as Innovation and Technology magazine put it in 2011, one of the young nation's first aging infrastructure dilemmas. Wilgus's solution was so forward-thinking that more than a century later, almost all of the elements he proposed are still embodied in Grand Central Terminal. The project involved demolishing more than 200 buildings in the area, blasting through layers of hard bedrock, and dismantling the glass-top train shed while trains still ran in and out below. Remarkably, the trains operated throughout the work, and ridership continued to climb. The first all-electric train left the old station building for the suburb of Yonkers on December 11, 1906, about 18 months ahead of the state's deadline. Finally, with the tracks completed, the new terminal began to rise in late 1911. What emerged was a wonder, still one of the largest train stations in the world and estimated to be one of the 10 most visited sites globally. Architect Frank J. Pryle, Jr., who worked on extensive renovations in the 1990s, likens its famed main concourse to a cathedral, especially when the sun streams through its high-arched windows. The defining characteristic of Grand Central Terminal is that it embraces and celebrates movement of trains, of people walking through to the trains and the street, of cars that go up and around it. The way the building is oriented, it also celebrates the motion of the sun rising in the east and setting in the west. Similar to a cathedral, Prowl says, Grand Central invites and honors this extraordinary collective energy, this gathering of people, this ability to be awestruck. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time today. That's the end of the broadcast. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading the article from the December 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. I hope you enjoyed it. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.